Welcome, everybody, to another episode of You're the Cure. Dr. Ben Edwards here. Veritas Medical is the is our clinic. VeritasMedical.com is the website. We've got a great interview lined up today. I'm super excited. As many of you know, when I transitioned into more of the integrative functional medicine family practitioner, and as opposed to a conventionally trained family practitioner, when I made the transition, first of all, it was a very eye-opening experience to understand that the body can fix itself. Most of these chronic diseases have root causes, and the root causes are really, if you drill down far enough, are based in diet and lifestyle choices that we make. And really, the four pillars, we call them nutrition, hydration, movement, and peace. And I've often said, really, it's three pillars with a foundation, and the foundation is the peace. If you can eat right, exercise right, and hydrate well, but if you're in fight or flight mode all day long and stressed, then your body's, the physiology of the human body just wasn't designed to function long-term, chronically, in fight or flight mode. And that is, in my opinion, we've talked to Dr. Caroline Leaf to give all the science behind how thoughts drive a lot of this fight or flight mode, thoughts that aren't based in the truth. And so the further we dive and drill down into health, what's real health and where's this disease coming from, it really kind of goes back down to this foundational thing of peace and the lack of peace. And that becomes a real personal journey and questions about, you know, who am I and why am I here and is there a creator, and really becomes a spiritual matter. And so that is why I've asked our guest today to come on the show, because I think there are a lot of people out there, even myself, although I was raised in the church, I had a lot of doubts and a lot of questions. I was also raised in science, in the doctor world, and higher education's full of all kinds of theories, including evolution, that can cause you to question the accuracy and reliability of the Bible. And to me, my personal opinion is true peace is going to come when your thoughts are lined up with truth, and the truth being the scriptures. But we got to start with, can I even trust the scriptures? So that's great, Doc. You know, God's going to give me peace, but I don't even know if there is a God. I don't even know if I can believe the Bible. So we need to address these kind of things. And we'll have other guests to do that too. But when I heard J. Warner Wallace give an interview on a docuseries online called Christ Revealed, which I highly recommend people check that out online, I thought, wow, we really need to talk to Mr. Wallace, because he came at this approach from a real kind of scientific, evidence-based, which is what doctoring is these days. It's all about evidence-based. And that's how Mr. Wallace approached the question of God and scripture and faith and Jesus, and is this thing called the Gospels and the Bible, is it reliable? So J. Warner Wallace is a Dateline featured cold case homicide detective, popular national speaker, best-selling author. Recommend his book Cold Case Christianity. That's also his website, coldcasechristianity.com. He's got an app, he's got a lot of great resources I highly recommend. He also serves as a senior fellow at the Colson Center for Christian Worldview. He's an adjunct professor of apologetics at Biola University, and also faculty member at Summit Ministries. And J. Warner became a Christ follower at the age of 35 after investigating the claims of the New Testament Gospels using his skills, the skill set that he had honed over all the years of being a detective for the Los Angeles Police Department. And so, Mr. J. Warner Wallace, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for agreeing to visit with us. I think your message is a resounding one that will help people at least at the minimum say, maybe I need to take a deeper dive into this thing. So thank you for joining us today.
Well, really glad to be here. Yeah, that's exactly what you're saying, is that there is no God. And a lot of other things fall out from that, right? And a lot of other, everyone has got a worldview that they build around these foundational questions. How do we get here? Why is it so messed up? And how do we fix it? Those are the three questions that worldview, every worldview seeks to answer. And regardless of where you may be and what you believe about the world around us, the universe around us, I suspect that your worldview seeks to answer those three questions. And of course, the success with which we can ask and answer those three questions is what gives us the kind of inner peace. But not, and I'll just tell you, though, that was not to me, that was not important. In other words, I would not seek to believe this because I'm seeking peace. I don't, to me, that the reality is the harsh reality. That's just the kind of cop in me, the detective in me says, hey, bad things happen to good people. Bad things happen all the time. It's just the way the world is. And I'm not going to embrace a lie just because it might serve some purpose for me. So I just needed to know, is this true? Is this view of the world true? Now, it may have a benefit to me, or it may not. It may have just the opposite. And that doesn't really matter. What matters is whether or not it's true. So I was just seeking to know that and be able to answer that question first. Now, what's great about it, of course, is it's not true because it works, or it's not true because it gives you peace, or whatever it may give you or not give you. It's not. That's not what makes it true. It's the fact that it's true that it has this derivative, that it has this other effect, this other thing that it offers. So that's where I want to, you know, I always try to make sure that we start from that perspective. What I was seeking more, first and foremost, like all my criminal cases, I may not like where this goes, but I need to know what's true so I can argue it in front of a jury.
Right. Well, let's go back to that moment or that season of your life. I know you were an atheist, I guess your whole life, but take the listeners back to that time when you were starting to wonder. What made you start to wonder, and what was your life like before that wondering, and then as you started to wonder and question, walk us through that.
Well, I was basically, I didn't have any, you know, my wife was somebody who was kind of raised culturally with a mother who was a Catholic, and so she, you know, she would go to church on the holidays, but really nobody, you know, my wife had never read a Bible. We just had a kind of she had kind of a cultural idea of the characters of the Bible. I was raised in an environment here in Los Angeles County that it's such a dense environment that we live in, that quite honestly, you go your whole life and never bump into Christians. I cannot recall a single Christian in my life growing up who had any influence on me at all. Friends or parents of friends or otherwise. Nobody, there was no outspoken Christian. I didn't know of any. If they were Christians, they never talked about it. So I didn't have to bump up against that issue very much. And I was somebody who just did not believe that was worth investigating. But my wife was more open to the idea. And so she, when we had kids, was kind of like, hey, should we raise up our kids with this belief system? And I quite frankly was more than happy to do it if she wanted to do it. I didn't think it was true though. Now, my dad also is somebody who doesn't think it's true, but thinks it has some value, even if it's a useful delusion. It still has some useful features. So he would say, if you want to do it, great, knock yourself out. He'll even go with you. He likes the culture that emerges from the Christian worldview, even though he doesn't think Christianity is true. So I was in the same position. So when I went, though, to the church for the first time, the very first message that was preached by the pastor was one that included a statement about the smartness, you know, how smart Jesus of Nazareth was, how he actually said he was the smartest man who had ever lived. And that provoked me to buy a Bible, and that's why I eventually, you know, back in the day when they had brick-and-mortar bookstores, I actually walked into a bookstore and bought a Pew Bible and started reading through it to see what was so smart about Jesus of Nazareth. Not really curious about whether God existed. I did not think he did. I didn't think any of the miracle accounts in the Gospels were probably true. But look, if there is somebody thinks for whatever reason that Jesus is smart, I kind of figured I owed it to myself to see if that was true. Also, I was somebody who, growing up in high school, you know, I was interested in the wisdom of, you know, kind of the fortune cookie wisdom of ancient sages. So that if that's all this ended up being, it might still have value. So I started to look to see if there was any wisdom in it. And as I examined it, I realized that this was a different kind of an account. It's not just a collection of wisdom statements. It's a collection of observations that the writers want us to believe actually happened. And that's what makes it different. So I thought, well, okay, I can test this because this is what I do for a living. I work cold case homicides. Those are just events in the past that I no longer have access to the witnesses because they have died. And a lot of times the report writers who took their initial eyewitness account, they've died too. So now I got to figure out, well, you know, what happened back then? And I don't have any access to the witness or to the person who writes about it. So I was able to use that same process, that same approach, and just started examining the accounts and they called the Gospels to see if there was any way we could test these to see if they actually were reliable. And that's really how I became a Christian. So my life before that, I had a great life, great marriage, great kids, great family, great job. Nothing was provoking me to make a change, unless, of course, it was true. And then, you know, if it's something that's true, I want to be able to live in that and not live in what I thought was true. And that's where I made a shift and became, you know, you could know everything there is to know about Jesus from the Gospels, yet not be a Christian. That's a whole other step. But before I could read what the Gospels had to say about me and my need for a Savior, I needed to know if I could trust what they were saying about the alleged Savior. So once I had kind of checked that box, I was able to read them comfortably to see what they said about me. And that's the shift you make from belief that something is true to belief in something.
Right. Well, you described in one of your articles or interviews I saw this process of taking the different colored highlighters and pens to the Gospels and just underlining and highlighting and making notations and cross-references and that. And I think it was even on the job, you were on a stakeout or something and one of your comrades caught you with a Bible. Can you recount that story? I thought it was quite funny.
Yeah, I think, you know, I've been doing this now for a number of months and not making a big deal of it, but like we have a lot of downtime when you work in surveillances. You have a lot of time in which you are you might be watching. So if a guy you're watching, you're undercover and you've got a bunch of cars, a bunch of guys on the team, and we're watching somebody who's about to do a crime, well, if he's not moving that day and he's just visiting a girlfriend, you might spend hours with him parked at her house. And if that's the case, one person's going to be watching to make sure he doesn't move while everybody else is on a perimeter taking time off, you know, waiting to be their turn on the eye to watch the guy who's parked at the house. So when you're sitting around for those other 6 hours, you're like going out of your mind because it's so boring and you're stuck in your car. You can't go anywhere. So I would bring my stuff to work and just sort through all the resources. You know, I bought a lot of church history. You know, you're trying to lock down whether or not this historical account is in fact historical. So I'm doing all that and months have gone by. And I think my partners were seeing that I was obsessed with something and my nature was changing a little bit. You know, I was starting to become a little more thoughtful, a little less reactive. I was less likely to criticize other Christians that we would meet because my partners and I would always criticize these Christians that we'd take to jail who would tell us all these God stories. And we're thinking to ourselves, really, well, whatever your God is doing, that doesn't seem to be preventing you from committing a felony, does he? So I just, you know, we would always mock these guys, but I was probably a little less eager to do that. And people noticed it. And so at one point, one of my partners kind of snuck up on me as I was on the perimeter waiting for this bad guy to go mobile. And it just immediately said, he called me out. He basically said, I knew it. I knew something was different about you. I knew now. And he also knows I'm obsessive compulsive. So if I'm going to go in any direction, I'm going to go all the way. And he immediately said, oh, you know, what's going to happen now? You're going to become a pastor. You're going to, you know, he was just, because he knew how adamant I was in the other direction. And he suspected that now that I was investing, if I ended up on this side of the ledger, he suspected I would be, you know, all in. Of course, I am. I'm all in because it's true. Right. If it was just something that I had an experience of, I don't think I could be. That's one of the great things about knowing that something is evidentially true. If you come at it this way, you could have a bad day. You could have a bad year. Something can shake you that might shake you altogether out of the system if you didn't know it was evidentially true. So what I think this does in this process of coming into this worldview through the evidence is it has a tendency to inoculate me from reacting emotionally in the moment to bad things that might happen in my life or that I might see in the world around me. So and it has done that for me. It has, by taking this approach, it has largely protected me from allowing my emotions to decide whether something is true.
Right. And in our world, especially today, and I don't see it getting better. But we tell our patients all the time, circumstances in the world and in your life, things are going to happen. these things that happen, though, you can walk through them still peacefully or more inoculated, as you say, if your thoughts, I mean, it's all about your reaction to these circumstances, and the reaction's based in your beliefs about yourself and about that worldview you're talking about. So it's exactly the point that we really try to teach and explain to the patients. But, and I love the evidentiary nature of this too. You know, I went to the largest Baptist university in the world, and freshman biology class, my freshman biology professor on the first day of class said, listen, if you're going to be a scientist, a biologist, a doctor, all you pre-med students, you've got to believe in evolution. It's true. It's just the way it is. And it was really from that point on, you hear it so much, and you assume the evidence is true on that side without digging deep. So that's what I love about, and of course this is different, we're not talking about evolution necessarily, but from your perspective, it's an eyewitness report. So you're a detective, a cold case. So by nature, these cold cases are years, like you said, these witnesses could be dead. The detectives that interviewed the witness could be dead. So there's no eyewitness. The reports of the eyewitness, you just have to look at these written accounts. So this skill set you developed over the years and were trained in, can you walk through some of that? I don't know that we have time for all of it, but as much as we do have time, explain to the listener, what is that? How do you assess an eyewitness? How do you assess their account? And then, you know, how did you apply that to scripture? Can you give some examples of some of these different techniques or tools that you use?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, what you described in terms of your experience, my son, David, also was a biochemist in his undergraduate work. And then now he's an anesthesiologist. So he went to med school out here in the West Coast at USC. And had very similar experiences in his OCHEM class, you know, his organic chemistry class, of these things, you know, where people come in with a very naturalistic kind of secular worldview and don't really see how this worldview as a Christian can ever navigate that world. Like, these are two separate kind of ways of looking at reality, and that they never really overlap. Of course, you know, I was David's youth pastor growing up, and so I was able to show him how, you know, like, all of us believe in change over time, and all of us believe that as a biological organisms, we change over time. We believe we all descended from Adam and Eve. So from a biblical worldview, all the diversity you see ethnically across the globe and racially across the globe comes from a single pair. So we do, of course, believe that there is some malleability within the organism, which is God-given, which is part of our divine design, so that it aids us in the survival process, right? The question, of course, is how far is that malleability? And so my son went in with that mindset and was able to protect himself from basically inferences that people will draw about how far the code allows for adaptation and how far it doesn't. And so he was very, you know, but knowing that in advance will actually help you. By the way, if he would have encountered that and I had to kind of convince him of that after the fact, or show him evidence of that after the fact, I think it would have been harder. I think going in, knowing in advance of what to expect and of why that isn't necessarily true, was helpful for him. Anyway, back to your question about the Gospels and how to navigate the Gospels. There's attributes of reliable eyewitness testimony that when we go in criminal trials, when we talk to juries and we explain to them how to test whoever comes on the stand and makes a claim, some people will be honest, some people will not. So you really want to be able to, argue and to show to the jury and make the closing statement or closing argument rather, or the opening statement, and help them to see, well, look, along the way, we want you to be able to evaluate the eyewitnesses. Well, how do you do that? Well, there's a list of things that we want them to consider. It's a list in almost every state. There's a list that the judge will use in what are called jury instructions. They will give these to juries. It breaks down into four areas. Number one, was the person really there to see what it is he said he saw? Two, can he be corroborated in some way? And I don't mean that he have to have a video that shows every single element of his eyewitness testimony, because that's never going to be the case. So if it is, you know, the video becomes your witness. But the point I'm trying to make, can he be corroborated by some piece of what I call touch point corroboration? Three, has he changed his story over time? And four, does he possess a bias that would cause him to lie to us? When we examine those four areas, that's how we determine if an eyewitness on the stand is reliable. And that's exactly what I tried to do with the Gospels. If we could examine them under those four areas, this is not the classic way that you examine historical accounts. But if you think about it, every criminal event eventually becomes an event in history. And if you're working cold cases, we just cleared a case 2 weeks ago. That was my dad's case originally. It occurred in 1972. Okay, well, now we are how many years after the fact? And we are now discussing it nearly 50 years later. This is now, of course, recent history, but it is an historical event that is tested in a very similar way. And so I think that's a reasonable approach to take with the Gospels. And that's what I did. I had to evaluate it under those four criteria. And I do think it's early. The Gospels were written early enough to have been written by people who could actually have seen this stuff with their own eyes, and to have been written at a time when people who would know if it was a lie could call them out. I think that's the first test, as are they early? And they are early. The second test, of course, is can they be corroborated? Well, you know, between archaeology and internal evidences and pagan accounts in the first and second century that describe the church, describe Jesus, describe the resurrection, describe the crucifixion, between that and other ways of testing internal and external evidence against the Gospels, I think they pass the test as well as any historical account of any ancient person, period. Third, have they changed over time? We can actually trace the transmission of the documents and the story from the original eyewitnesses through their students and the students of those students and the students of the students of those students through history, and we can see if the story has changed. And finally, what causes people to lie to begin with? What are the motives that motivate people to say something that's not true? Well, it turns out there are only three motives for any lie, for any misbehavior at all, including a murder. And that is financial greed, sexual lust, and the pursuit of power. So we can actually evaluate the eyewitnesses or the authors of the Gospels under those three criteria. If you do, you will find that they probably have as little motive as anybody who's recorded anything in history. So I think in the end, I had to be realistic with myself and say, look, I get it. These include miracle accounts. That's, to me, the biggest problem. Is that if you just had accounts of Jesus that included nothing miraculous, who would doubt the historicity of Jesus of Nazareth? Nobody. What makes you doubt the historicity of Jesus is the fact that these accounts appear to have supernatural elements that we reject out of hand because we have a bias against the supernatural. And by the way, wherever in the world there is a stronger bias against the supernatural, that's where it's harder to communicate and convince people of the Christian worldview.
Yeah.
So I think that's part of what is the limiter for us. And we have to be realistic about our biases. We have a bias also. We are biased against the supernatural.
Right. And I just want to remind folks, naturalist worldview, a naturalist thinking versus a supernatural. So, and I think it was you that put it this way, Jay Warner. In a naturalist worldview, you're going to say basically that everything in the universe can be accounted for by stuff found in the universe, by physics and chemistry and matter, time, space. All this stuff came from and can be accounted for by other stuff, by natural stuff, versus the supernatural belief that, no, you can't account for everything with just the stuff that's in the natural matter and time and space and energy and physics and all that stuff. There has to be something outside of the natural, outside of this chemistry and matter and protons and neutrons and electrons. There has to be something outside of that. That's the basic thing we're talking about here. And I think it's pretty clear if you get into quantum physics, especially, there has to be. I mean, there's so many, from consciousness to just even moral truth. I mean, to say that it's all just natural, I think it's kind of a stance that's not really defensible.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think if you look at this, you know that there's two ways of looking at the universe. One, that everything is governed by just the stuff of the universe, space, time, matter, acted upon by physics and chemistry. That is it. Everything that you find in the universe then has to be explained using space, time, matter, physics, and chemistry. You can't go outside of those causes, because to go outside of those causes puts you outside of naturalism. And by naturalism, we simply mean that that everything that we see in the universe can be accounted for by naturalistic causes and elements. Now, here's the problem with that. I believed, as an atheist, that the universe came into existence from nothing. Big Bang cosmology. That's still the standard cosmological model for anyone in cosmology. I mean, look, in the end, that the reason why that's so broadly accepted is because that seems to be the best and most reasonable inference from the scientific evidence. But that means that we're looking at a universe that came into existence from nothing. That word nothing is key, because there was no space, time, or matter prior to the universe, according to the science, not according to my, interpretation of Genesis 1. And what that means is that the first cause has to be non-spatial, non-temporal, non-material. That means you're already outside of what you would call a naturalistic cause. I think most of us believe in, if we stop and think about it, we believe there is something afoot in the universe beyond just a pure naturalism, strict natural. The only question we have is that first cause outside of space, time, and matter, is that cause personal or impersonal? That's really where the debate is. Is it personal? Because everyone believes there's a cause outside of space, time, and matter that causes the universe to come into existence. That cause is all-powerful, has to be incredibly powerful to create everything from nothing, and it cannot consist of anything spatial, temporal, or material. The only question left is the cause personal? I think there's lots of good reason to believe the cause is personal. And I talk about that in a book, by the way, called God's Crime Scene. But my point is, once you are in that position, well, now you've just opened the door to all kinds of supernatural realities that suddenly make the Gospels look less controversial. Because you're no longer saying, hey, I can't accept that there's something outside of space, time, and matter that's afoot here. So why would I suspect that the only part of the – if there is a God, that if there is a personal cause that's all-powerful, non-spatial, non-temporal, non-material, that's strong enough to create the universe from nothing, then every New Testament miracle is small potatoes. So I think you at least have to be realistic and honest about that, because it opens the door to other ways of thinking.
Right. Well, when we come back from the break, I want to maybe take a little deeper dive into some of the other possible explanations. And I think you even, thought about these other potential explanations for this thing called the resurrection, that little miracle. Like maybe Jesus didn't really die. He wasn't quite dead, and he just resuscitated. And there's some other common kind of potential explanations besides, the Gospels are exactly true as they're written, what they claim is true. So when we come back from the break, we may dive into some of those and how you use some of these detective skills and evidential witness, eyewitness type skills to delineate out truth versus non-truth and some of these other explanations. So y'all stick with us. We are talking with J. Warner Wallace. ColdCaseChristianity.com is the website, podcast, books, and all kinds of resources there. So y'all check out that. And of course, this is Ben Edwards with You're the Cure. Stick with us. We'll be right back. All right, everybody, welcome back. We are excited to have author J. Warner Wallace with us and cold case homicide detective teaching us some of the skills that he's used over the 35 years in his career on the police force in Los Angeles and applying that to questions of the authenticity and reliability and truthfulness of the Gospels, the Bible. So before the break, I mentioned we were going to dive a little deeper into some of these other explanations that some folks who still don't believe in God, don't believe the Gospels are true. And I mentioned the one about maybe just it was a resuscitation, not a resurrection. And there are others too. I'll maybe let you pick some of your favorite ones, but explain some of the evidence and some of your detective skills that you use to decide that this is just not a plausible explanation. Yes, I know people put it out there, but when you actually take a close look, it's simply not plausible. So maybe we'll start with that. Those that say, well, this this Jesus guy, maybe he was real and wise and walking around teaching people some cool stuff, but, and, you know, they maybe tried to hang him on this cross and kill him, but he didn't really die. So what makes you think, Mr. J. Warner Wallace, that it really was a death and a resurrection?
Well, I think part of what helps, I think, people to think about how you would even examine something like this is to know just a little bit something about, number one, detective process, and number two, the rules of evidence, right? So let's talk about the process we might use. One of the things we do when we examine claims like this is we do something called let me try to give it to you a way of thinking about logically. We do something called abductive reasoning. It's a logical thinking process by which we compare explanations to evidence. So in other words, if you came into a scene and you weren't sure if it was a crime scene, but you had several pieces of evidence, you would develop in your mind, well, okay, what are the different ways I could explain this evidence? And then you would start comparing the evidence to your explanations and rule out the explanations that don't seem reasonable anymore. So that's the first thing. This process we're going to use is called abductive reasoning. And it's simply a way, it's also called inferring to the most reasonable explanation. Now, the next thing that might be helpful is to have a rule in place, a way of thinking about the nature of evidence. And that's to be able to understand the difference between possible and reasonable. So I never use the word plausible because, to be honest, we never use that in front of jurors. And so if you're going to be involved in a jury trial at some point, you're going to get to learn some of the language that attorneys use, that the judge is going to use, and that should be helpful as you examine the claims of the prosecutor and compare them to the claims of the defense attorney. And so what we'll talk about is the nature of reasonable and possible. And we talk about that specifically when we talk about the judicial standards. So for example, we're not trying to prove something beyond a possible doubt because you could never prove anything beyond a possible doubt. As a matter of fact, anything and everything is – judges actually instruct jurors. They say, hey, you got to let go of your possible doubts because judges will typically say in California, I could level an imaginary or possible doubt against any claim you think you know with certainty. So we have to get beyond that. I've never proved anything beyond a possible doubt in any criminal trial because it's just not possible to do that based on the nature of claims. You're always going to have an unanswered question in every criminal trial. I have my share of unanswered questions even when I'm presenting a case to a jury. So I, the first thing I try to help people understand is we're trying to get to not what is possible because anything and everything is possible. So if you said to me, is it possible this guy in this our case – you know, didn't do it, of course it's possible, but it's not reasonable. And that's the standard we're trying to get to, not beyond a possible doubt, because I could never convict anybody. It would be beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, why is that helpful? Because we're going to look at the explanations for the resurrection. And I think that's a really significantly important thing to do. I actually think that we have been commanded by God through Paul when he writes to the Corinthian church to investigate the claims of the resurrection with great diligence, because Paul says these are the most important claims of Christianity. If the resurrection did not occur, then everything is a lie. There is no hope of a future resurrection for anybody who believes in Christianity. And Paul says you've been lied to. We've been false witnesses who have lied to you and convinced you of something that is not true. So I think it's important for us and reasonable for us to look at the resurrection claims and to test them. And to ask the question, you know, is this the most reasonable inference from evidence? Now, what that means is we're going to make a list of all the evidence in the room and then make a list of all the ways to explain that evidence. And I think that if you made a list of all the evidence, I would have only given you a few things as an atheist. You were not going to get a lot out of me. It would be, what about the resurrection that I actually believe as an atheist? Well, I believe that there was a claim. I mean, Christianity is built on this claim. Doesn't mean the claim is true, but I would admit, yes, there was a claim. I would admit also, because I think it's, to be honest, with an agnostic or an atheist examining this, if he really is going to be honest with the evidence, the idea that there was no Jesus, that this is just some mythological character, is not reasonable. It's just not. And so I would have said, yeah, okay, there's a Jesus who lived, even if he died on a cross and was buried, this does not mean Christianity is true. Even if people said afterwards that they saw him alive, this does not mean that actually happened. Even if those people were willing to die for their claims, this does not mean that they actually occurred. But I would have given you at least those minimal truths about Jesus and the resurrection, that he lived, he died on a cross, he he was reportedly seen after his death and burial, and that the people who saw this were so committed they were transformed by their claims. But I would have argued, so what? This does not make it true in any sense, because people say all kinds of crazy things. And so I would have given you a set of ways to explain those basic evidences, explanations. And I would have given you six that are not Christian explanations. They're the atheist explanations, that either they were lying about it, they hallucinated it, they were influenced by somebody who hallucinated it. Maybe he didn't die at all. He was just badly injured. It looked like he was dead, came back from a bad injury. That there's an imposter maybe who set in on it, or maybe the entire story is part of the late legend that developed over time. Maybe Jesus lived, but none of that stuff actually occurred the way it's reported to occur, because that is the legend that developed over time. So there's six explanations right there that you could hold as an atheist, yet still deny that Christianity is true. And I was one of those people who would have said, yeah, I think that you could make those claims, but still deny it's true. But here's the problem. As I went through each of those six non-Christian explanations, they don't work. I mean, are they all possible ways to explain it? Yes. Are they all reasonable ways to explain it? No. And I'll grant you that the Christian explanation I also thought was unreasonable, because it involves a resurrection. It involves something supernatural, and I rejected things like supernatural claims. I rejected them thoroughly. But that comes back to our first part of the discussion, where we talked about, do we have good reason to think that the only mechanisms, the only active causes in the universe are based purely on space, time, matter, physics, and chemistry? And I think we all know, at least I mean, there's lots of other reasons. How do you account for mind? How do you account for objective a moral truth? How do you account for the appearance of design in both the universe and in biology? How do you even account for the beginning of life and biological creatures who allegedly come into existence from non-living matter? So I think there's lots of things you cannot explain given on a pure kind of naturalistic perspective. And if that's the case, if you're open to the possibility, the reasonable inference, in fact, that there's more at work in the universe than just space, time, and matter, well, then that objection that the resurrection requires something outside of space, time, and matter, that has to be laid down at least long enough to investigate it. I think in the end, the only thing that makes the Christian explanation unreasonable is our bias against anything extra natural. And once you're able or willing to lay that down, then the Christian explanation is far more reasonable than the thought that he died, or didn't die rather, or that they lied about it, or they hallucinated it, or that there was an imposter, or that this is just legend. So I just spend time. All of this, by the way, is the stuff that I looked at before I ever thought about becoming a Christian. I thought everybody did that, by the way. I thought everybody took a step, a process that was similar. I just didn't know that that wasn't the case, that for most of us who are in the church or believe Christianity is true, did not go through this kind of process. But for me, it was kind of essential. I had to look at that first before I could take a step of trust.
Right. Well, which one of those six possible but not reasonable explanations was the hardest one for you to overcome, or were they all equal? And how did you overcome some of those, specifically using your background as a detective?
Well, let me give you an example. So I think you can look at each of these and to see the problem with the claim. So I've worked a lot of conspiracies in my career, and so we learn how to break conspiracies. There are, of course, a number of times when someone is successful in getting away with a conspiracy, but it's not, you can't point those out, because if you're successful, it's because no one caught it. No one, that means that it still remains, some of people believe something that no one's even suspecting that it's not true, because you've had such a successful conspiracy. Most of the conspiracies people point to, they are examples of unsuccessful conspiracies, and they fell apart for the same reasons why all conspiracies fall apart, the same strategies we take in trying to break conspiracy theories or conspiracies. You know, that's additional charge that we can add if two or more people are involved in a murder. I can add the charge of conspiracy, and typically how I end up solving a lot of my murders is that luckily more than one person's involved, and I can break down the lie. I can break down the conspiracy, because it takes five things to be successful in the conspiracy. Number one, you want the smallest possible number of co-conspirators. So two people can tell a lie a lot easier than 20. You also want to hold it for the shortest period of time. It's easier to hold a lie for a day than it is to hold it for a year. You also want to be able to have excellent communication between the co-conspirators, because at some point, someone is going to get questioned. This is why the first thing we do when we have more than one suspect in a case is we separate them, right, before we interview them, because we know that as we get into the weeds and we get into the details and ask detailed questions, that they will not have been able to cover all of that in advance. And we will find little areas where they're now disagreeing with each other. Because the lie is now, I mean, every what might seem like a simple lie has a thousand small attributes that you can mine in the investigation and in the interview that you probably haven't covered with your co-conspirator. And we can see if those details match. Also, you want to do it with somebody who you have a really close, strong, and hopefully a family relationship, like brothers will just shut up. They won't say anything at all to hurt a brother, or a son is never going to, well, at least a mom's not going to rat out her son. Although sons do sometimes rat out their parents. But the point is, you want to have a close family relationship. And finally, if you can avoid being asked, just avoid the pressure, kind of fly under the radar, those five things will help you to be successful in a conspiracy. The problem I see with the Christian notion that there's a conspiracy amongst 600-plus Christians, according to Paul, there were 500 who saw the risen Christ on one day that were still available to the church in Corinth, right, that they could actually talk to. He says most are still alive, yet some, only a few have fallen asleep, have died. So the idea that we have a conspiracy held for 60 plus years by 500 to 600, I mean probably a lot more than that, but just being conservative, people who have to keep the lie for 60 plus years when they're under the most intense pressure, without any way to communicate, separated us from as far away as India to at least to Rome. How in the world? Okay, look, is that possible? Yes, it's possible. It's not reasonable, though, because everything you would need to be successful in a conspiracy is missing in this one. And I don't make those rules up when it comes to conspiracies. That's just how we work conspiracies in criminal investigations. But if I had a conspiracy, if someone just told me off the top of their head, I got a conspiracy, I think 500 people are involved, I'm already out. But then to add the other four things, which are even more detrimental, okay, yeah, you can believe it if you want. I just don't think it's a reasonable explanation. But I would tell you, is it possible? Yeah, it's possible. But I'm not interested in what's possible. I've never been interested in possible. I'm only interested in reasonable.
Yeah. So the explanation that the whole thing was just a lie, it was a conspiracy, it just really falls apart from a standpoint of those who study conspiracy.
If you've ever had to investigate a conspiracy, like, you get frustrated, you want to get to the truth. So you learn how to investigate conspiracies. That's one of the first things we learn. I actually learned that before I was actually, I spent 2 years working gangs before I was transferred into our detective division, although gangs was part of detectives back in those days. But the point is, I actually learned that pretty early in my career working gangsters, because we'd always do things in groups. And all the cases I worked involved more than one person committing the crime, and I had to figure out how to break the conspiracy. And a lot of it comes down to those. It's always comes down to those five things.
Well, talk about some of the physical evidence on the one explanation that, well, maybe Jesus was on the cross, but he just got hurt real bad and he recovered. You know, some of the physical things described in the Gospels and what you experienced with, you know, dead bodies.
Well, I mean, I think you know this too, and this is something my son and I have talked about quite a bit, is, you know, what I think part of the problem is in 21st century right now, most people that we know, that we are working with, or that we even our social groups, have never really seen a dead body. Now, you've seen dead bodies. I've seen dead bodies. My son has certainly seen dead bodies. Both my sons, they got one police officer and one doctor. So we get a chance to see what most people don't see. And they have a vision or an idea about death that is derived largely from Hollywood, you know, so the idea of what a dead body looks like, they don't understand the characteristics. There are a couple of things that I think are different, though, about the first century. In the first century, there was no coroner to call if you had a suspicious death. There was no mortuary to call if you had a non-suspicious death. When someone died, just like when someone gave birth, you got your hands dirty. You had to actually get involved with your family members who had just passed away. This was not unusual. This is, a matter of fact, the norm, not the exception. And so these people had a view, had an understanding of death, which was unlike those of us in the 21st century. As a matter of fact, where they were in time both helped and hurt them. Let me explain to you what I mean. It hurt them in the sense that they did not recognize a feature of death that we now understand scientifically, and is described in one of the Gospels, where it says that Jesus was stabbed with a spear. And the Gospel of John, the fisherman John, says that when the spear was pulled from his chest cavity, water was seen as separated from blood coming out of his chest cavity. That's a very interesting description of what he saw, because in the first century, he was not even aware what that meant. As a matter of fact, I've read all of the church fathers in the first 500 years of the church also did not believe, they didn't understand what that water was about. As a matter of fact, when describing that passage in the Gospel of John, they would always say that that's not water at all. It can't be water, because why would water be separated from blood? It must be a symbol. John is using it allegorically or metaphorically to describe the baptism of, or to describe the Holy Spirit, to describe something, because it could not have been real water. And part of it was, in the first century, they didn't understand this thing called pleural effusion, which is typically the result of some form of cardiac arrest, where water will collect either in the sac around your heart, or it'll accumulate in your lungs. If you happen to be in the right position, probably erect, then you're going to be, you know, if you're in an upright position, then if I stab you in the chest cavity and I hit your lung, you will see that water come out. But that means you already have good evidence that he's dead, because that's probably the result of cardiac arrest. That's the most reasonable inference from that type of physical evidence on the body. Now John didn't know that. And when he wrote it, he didn't try to explain it. He just included what he saw. And then for centuries afterwards, the people who read it, who also didn't understand the science, tried to figure out what the heck he was talking about. Now, what's interesting, though, there was an aspect of being in the first century that actually helped them, it hurts us. The same way that lack of scientific knowledge hurt him, well, there's a lack of scientific knowledge that hurts us reading the text, because most people don't handle dead bodies the way that first century readers did. And I will tell you that this thing we call the mortis triad, those three features of dead bodies that are unique to dead bodies, I know if you're handling dead bodies in the first century, you already know. You may not call it the mortis triad, but you're familiar with what happens to your body. When I describe this to audiences today, they're like, really? They haven't thought about that. Yeah, I guess that would be. They have no idea that was actually the case. But what happens with dead bodies is that you will see things change when your heart stops beating. When your heart stops pushing warm blood, then gravity starts to draw it. It's either one force or the other is acting on your blood, either the force of that pump in your chest or the force of gravity if the pump's not working. And so that means if your heart stops beating, you're going to see a couple of things happen. Number one, you're going to cool down. You will be cooler to the touch. I've never handled a dead body that I've mistook for a live body. Two, you're going to stiffen up. You're going to be non-responsive. Your skin is even going to start to have a lack of elasticity. These are things that are true of dead bodies. First is called algor mortis. The second is called rigor mortis. If you die in a cross position, you're not just going to flop to the ground like a limp, unconscious being. You're going to be stiff. You're going to be slowly moving back into position, or you're going to have to force you back into position because you're going to have rigor mortis. The third mortis is called liver mortis, and that's probably the most compelling, because if your heart stops beating and you're in a cross position, gravity is going to draw the blood. When I get to a death scene and someone's lying on his back and I roll him over, his back is red and purple because all the blood has been drawn to his skin, drawn to his back, and I can see it like a big bruise. The same is true if you're hanging in a cross position. Your feet are going to swell. Your feet are going to turn color. If you really think Is it possible they could have missed these three aspects of death in the first century when they were familiar with what death looked like, and they could have accidentally buried a living person? Yeah, anything's possible, but that is not reasonable. And I think part of why we can even suggest such a thing is because we're just not familiar with what death looks like. But once you are, that is not a reasonable inference.
Right. We have time maybe for one more. And the one I'm thinking of, I think you said, I heard you say one time, it's the one problem or one objection that even you had the most trouble with, and that was the fact there wasn't a single, this was not an original manuscript, the Gospels, the copies of the Gospels. We didn't have an original. We didn't even have a copy of the original. So folks who want to throw that out there, how do you assess that from the standpoint of how could something be reliable if it wasn't the original document?
Yeah, well, okay, so that's a pretty common objection you hear. Bart Ehrman, as a matter of fact, wrote a whole book on this where he argued that his first point of being shaken as a Christian who then later became a non-Christian was that when he discovered that we didn't have a single original autograph, an original manuscript. So if you look, his argument was, we don't have a single original manuscript. Of course, I don't know why we would expect to have anything that ancient where we'd have the original, given the kinds of writing materials that were used in the first century. But regardless, he would say, you don't even have the first copy of the original. Now, we don't know that for sure. We don't know which generation of copies we have of the originals, but we do recognize that what we have are copies of the originals. So the question is, and he finds that there are variations between those copies that we do have. The most ancient copies we have are varied. But if I'm honest with you, even he would say, well, they're varied, but not in the way that we would cause them to be untrustworthy, because the variations between the Gospels really account for no key claim of the Gospels. So while you might have a variation in a word, that the variations that exist do not impact the claims related to the nature of Jesus, to the nature of the events surrounding Jesus' life. I mean, these are all small variations that don't change the claims of the Gospels to begin with. But look, if we didn't have anything, if we didn't have any biblical manuscripts at all, and all we had were the claims of the students of the authors of the Gospels, because these authors had students. John had students. Paul had students. Mark had students. Matthew had students. In other words, there were people who sat at the feet of the eyewitnesses and learned from them, and then wrote their own letters describing what they learned from those people. You'd still be stuck with the same kind of Jesus, the same historical figure that we see on the pages of the Gospels, even if you had no Gospels, because all those features that you are most inclined to say, well, that can't be true. You know, the virgin birth, the miracles, the resurrection, the ascension, all that stuff is in the letters of those who sat at the feet of the gospel authors. So you're stuck with those claims. Those are early claims made by the people who said they were eyewitnesses, and they are repeated without change throughout history. Now, I will tell you that what we interpret from those claims, that has been argued throughout history. So whether or not Jesus said X, but what we think he means is Z. Well, there's lots of people who will argue about what the Z is, but everyone agrees he said the X. Now, how we interpret those claims, that's different. But I'm not interested in how you interpret. I just want to know, what did he say? I think I've got enough of a ability to interpret from the manuscripts what is meant by that. But I just want to know, what did he say? I think we're stuck with that. Like, I always put it this way. If you said, and no one is saying this, but if you said that, Bart often says something like this, that there are more variations between the gospel accounts than there are words in the New Testament. And he's counting these small one-word variations, you know, where it says his word over God's word, or Jesus' word over his word, or whatever it may say, that words are slightly different. I get that. But I would always put it as a thought experiment out there. Look, if I said to Bart, I am willing to take out the entire verse where you find a single variant and not trust it, just excise it from the text. He's not suggesting that, by the way, but I'm willing to go that step further. Even more than that, I'm willing to take out every fourth verse just randomly. Better than that. How about this? I'll take out every odd or even verse, you pick it. That's more than any skeptic is saying is unreliable in the Gospels. If I took out 50% of the verses, every even or odd verse, just for sake of argument, what would we still know about Jesus? Oh my gosh. Well, first of all, a lot of those verses are going to come back in, because if you take them out in John, in the parallel account in Matthew, or if you take them out in Mark, there's a parallel account in Luke, it may just come right back in again because you're not taking it out in Luke. But if you did take all out, you'd still be stuck with the story of Jesus. Every date, now it may be a more clumsy read, but you're still going to be stuck with all the same data points. So I don't know what we're arguing about here. I mean, even if you thought there was some level of distrust you wanted to accuse the Gospels of, you could never, no skeptic is charging the Gospels with the level of distrust that I just described. Yet if you had that level of distrust, you'd still be stuck with a reliable account. And that's the problem. I think in the end, I realized you got to do something with the account.
Right. And the mild variations between the different Gospel authors, between Matthew, between Luke, these variations actually support, I mean, you wouldn't want an identical, you know, if you were investigating a crime and you heard the very exact same identical story from four different witnesses, that would be less credible, wouldn't it? You need to see a little bit of, because everybody sees everything a little bit different, I think I've heard you say. But that actually lends more credibility to the Gospels, the slight variations from one to the next.
Yeah, I see nothing in the variations between the accounts, and I think they are varied. I think they are very different. I think the accounts make very different claims related to the same timeline. If you were looking at, for example, the Passion Week, you could look at those four versions of the Passion Week and say, wow, they are pretty different in certain places. But this is exactly what you see in every eyewitness account of any criminal activity, any historical event. I typically have one thing I ask dispatchers to do when they dispatch me to a call to a homicide. I just ask them to have the witnesses, the officers who are on scene, separate the eyewitnesses, because I know that if I don't separate those eyewitnesses and they're allowed to talk to each other when I get there, there will be too much agreement. They will sort. They will kind of try to sort out and understand and work through the distinctions. So that they end up having a much more uniform story. That is not helpful. I don't want a uniform story. Uniform stories, that they just aren't. If all skeptics, if all there was one account, they would be skeptical of that account. If there were four accounts that were word for word identical, they would have no more trust. They'd have less trust related to the Gospel accounts. So I think we have to be realistic about this. The variation between the accounts is exactly what we should expect if, in fact, the accounts are true, because this is the nature of eyewitness testimony. And if you're somebody, and that's why I'll be honest with you, I see a lot of modern scholars who claim a Christian identity. You know, these are people who would say, no, I'm a believer, and I'm a biblical scholar. But they've got a theory. When they try to reconcile the differences between the accounts, I will see them argue, oh, yeah, this is a genre of literature that allows for the author to say things that aren't true, to exaggerate a little bit, and that explains why we see differences between. No, that is not necessary. There's no reason to jump to genre to explain differences in eyewitness accounts. Unless, of course, you've never worked with eyewitnesses. And one of the things, the advantage I think we have when we get to interview a bunch of eyewitnesses over the course of 25 years, is that when I first opened those accounts, those Gospel accounts, and I read them, I was not at all shaken by the differences. As a matter of fact, I was encouraged by the differences, because I thought, oh, this looks and feels very much like a reliable account, because this is exactly what reliable accounts look like. So, yeah, I would say that the differences between the account are one of the beautiful things about the accounts that at least give me an early pointer that I should investigate them further.
Yeah. Well, we are out of time, unfortunately. The hour has sped by. Thank you, Jay Warner Wallace, for being with us. Tell the listeners, what's the best way to follow you, to learn more, to dive in more to your teachings and how you approach.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, we've got a website called Cold Case Christianity, and we've got a kids academy called Casemakers Academy. So at coldcasechristianity.com and casemakersacademy.com, you'll find all of our work.
Awesome. Well, I encourage everybody to check that out, coldcasechristianity.com. J. Warner Wallace, thank you very much again for being with us. It's Dr. Ben Edwards with You're the Cure. Join us next week for another episode. Thank you.